Hello and welcome to the RTE Rugby Podcast. Michael Glennon here this week, sitting in for Neil Tracy, who's on a well-deserved break after a brilliant touring performance with the Lions in Australia. Later on in the show, we're going to talk to Hannah O'Connor about the World Cup coming up and Ireland's warm-up games, the win over Scotland last weekend, and the upcoming game against Canada at the Affidavit Stadium. In Belfast on Saturday, but we don't let everyone off without turning their homework in for the summer break yet. And delighted to have Johnny Holland and Johnny Murphy to go over the Lions Test series. Guys, welcome on board.
Cheers, thanks, Mark Favros.
We will look back at the series in a minute, but for a dead rubber match, there was a lot of talking points in the third test. And maybe just to set the narrative coming into it, but I guess the first test had kind of gone according to plan. The Wallabies weren't great and the Lions were very comfortable. The Australians responded in the second test, really put it up, but blew an 18-point lead and Hugo Keenan scored a famous series-winning try. I would have thought that that was it for Australia. I would have favoured a 3-0 win just because the momentum and the energy that the performance had taken out of Wallabies, the emotional energy they spent, the injuries leading up to it, would have pointed me towards a clean sweep. But Johnny, in your column this week on RTE.ie, you were telling us the why of why that wasn't the case. Just elaborate a bit on the hunger stakes or why it played out the way it did.
Yeah, like I suppose Johnny, it's not the first time I'm gonna be smug here on this end, but I called it with a lack of confidence what day was it? Thursday. But I didn't know if I was
Thursday, yeah.
really believing in it. Like, and I suppose the reason I thought the Wallabies might win the game was because it was nothing to do with the weather even at the time, even though they played the conditions a lot better than the Lions, but they maybe defended a bit more valiantly. But I suppose that plays into the point of like, they were doubted, 3-0 whitewash, hadn't happened in 100 years or whatever it was like. And I think it's just the desperation for a win. Like, I think what it meant to them. So I suppose what it meant on one side and what it may not have meant on the other side. So like the Wallabies, being challenged, potentially feeling hard done by last week, not wanting rugby in Australia to go backwards and maybe being a laughing stock as a sport compared to the other ones. Like, there's loads of reasons why, Matt Williams, for whatever he may put on the record, the part about, Australians being fairly, hurt by people calling for the Lions being taken away from Australia. Like, all those things play into the whole thing. Like, so I think that's why their was very strong. And then when you think about the other side of it, I don't know how much this plays into it, but the Lions were celebrating a series win the week before. They were probably able to, I know Hugo Keenan had a bit on an interview before the game and it rolled into Sunday and they probably went for an enjoyable Sunday afternoon, So like, and then when you pick a lot of the same team, I don't know how they're feeling physically. Obviously they're professionals, they get prepared and everything else. I don't know how much that comes into it, but it does have a small effect on your body. But it's more so when the lightning strikes come in and the rain is torrential, where do you really want to be? Probably getting home with your families at that stage. And that's probably why I thought the Wallabies would have had a chance, and I suppose it turned out that way, that they played for each other a little bit more than what I felt the Lions did. And it's funny what psychology in sport does, because I have a massive issue with this whole narrative around, oh, Australia were a controversial penalty away from winning the series. They absolutely were miles away from that, because if they were about to win the series, or the third test would have been very, very different psychologically. So people would think that, the Jack Morgan penalty was the difference in the series. It fully wasn't, because that's not how sport works. And every action has a reaction, So if the Lions didn't win that one, I'm sure they would have prepared differently. They would have turned up differently, and you'd hope they would have played differently, because I think they were, I wouldn't say they let themselves down. They were home and hosed. They were going on holidays, but Australia beat them like very comfortably, I thought.
Do you go along with that, Johnny?
Yeah, I do. I think that a couple of things probably went against the Lions in the sense of the, I think the narrative and the bounce that they got from that. Matt Williams was very vocal during the week, as Johnny's already said, that they felt quite disrespected at times through different commentary. And then, the forecast plays a huge amount into it and how bad the rain was. And you look at upset throughout throughout sport, particularly in rugby, it does have a huge amount into it. And they just got to the level they needed to, like, kind of straight off the bat. Skelton was unbelievable. I think if you were to pick someone that has had an influence on a series outside of someone like Tadhg Byrne, Will Skelton is there. You know how much it kind of showed over the last 2 weeks, how much he was missed in the first test. And even the lightning break gives someone like him, who probably doesn't have the engine to go 80 minutes, it gives him a break to get going again. And yeah, just try to chase a game in conditions like that, so hard. And you know, their try down the wing, which comes from you know, chasing out the blind side and kind of overplaying ball to ground. It's not an intercept, but it more or less is. It's against where they're at. That just kind of kills momentum for the Lions. And yeah, I just think everything kind of played up towards where they were. Kind of played into the narrative and played into their hands where they were mentally and everything going. So yeah, it was I suppose it was a disappointing end for the Lions, but as you say, they had the job done after 2 weeks. So
if that's the mental side of it, if that's the mental side of it, or the psychological side of it, and we give Andy Farrell good credit for his selection, for his ability to pick guys, his man management, his ability to read the players. Did Andy Farrell get his selection wrong? Is it easy to say that now in hindsight, but it could have done with a bit more freshening up?
I think in hindsight, you can question it, but I think if you go into it, I've kind of touched on this as well, that like, if he changes too much and they lose, you say, oh, he lost cohesion and he disrespected the tour. So as I was writing it, I was thinking, you know, the 50-50 calls, you might swing the other way. The Josh Vanderfleers, I'm not asking to start him in this whole Irish media piece, but like, start Jack Morgan and put Vanderfleer on the bench. Tom Curry was actually good, to be fair, and it's a game that he would play well in, like those tight and physical games. But at the same time, he's got a wrist surgery pending. He's had a long season of in and out with injuries. Like, it's, these are things that just play on your mind. Like, and I suppose I'm not trying to disrespect the Lions, because players think they're up for it. They're playing a Lions test, third test, and they're looking for a whitewash. I'm sure the narrative would have been strong all week. But I just wonder when the ball is on the deck, who's going to try harder? You know what I mean? And it's not the guy who's waiting for a wrist surgery. So sometimes it's, you know, the 50-50 calls I think you can swing. But then in fairness to him, like, he did pick Blair Kinghorn over James Lowe, and he did put James Ryan into the mix. So he probably did a couple. Maybe he didn't do enough. But at the same time, there are times when there's a group psychology, or there's a way things fall, and it's very hard, no matter who you are, to bring it back. Like, they have Gary Keegan on site as well, who people talk about so much. You know, they're a psychologist, they've got everything at their disposal. If it's that easy to turn it around, they would have just turned it around, like, you know. So there's loads of things played into it. As Johnny kind of touched on, they also went behind early. Australia came out of the blocks, and you could just stay patient, pick off a bit of territory and pick off 3 and 6 points, and you're back in the game. But at the same time, you know, they went behind on the scoreboard, and it just makes you, it doesn't make you panic, but it definitely makes you force things a small bit more. I don't know if the selection was wrong. I think it's too basic to say it was. He could have changed one or two more things, but we couldn't predict that being the winning of the game. I do think, like, how they played the game tactically, they tried to do the right things, but Finn Russell dropping the ball in front of him because of rain doesn't really happen. And that led to the 8 point lead, I think. And even the one that Johnny mentioned there, the mistake for Detroit that kind of killed the game off, the Max Jorgensen try. Owen Farrell puts that on his boot 9 times out of 10. You know, they're running out of space of a flat four. Aki's early, Kinghorn is in no man's land. He just treads that through. That's what we saw from him in the early parts of his tour, where they're his strengths that he was bringing. So he just tread that through, and he turned Australia. Maybe they make a knock-on error and just come the other way, and all of a sudden there's a chance of getting back in the game. So very, very small things. So I think it's too reductive maybe to say that it was a selection issue, but I think things would have played out differently. Sorry, last thing, like a Johnny voice, but I think if you could predict that game and the weather conditions, you might actually play Owen Farrell at 12. You know, I didn't think Andy or Bundyaki played a great game, obviously, a couple of errors. Owen Farrell restarting that game at 12 as a second kicking option, man manager. If you could play it back, you'd probably do that, but you can't play it back in sport, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I think that I think the result. It's purely a result outcome there, where people going, oh, you should have freshened it up, you should have done this. It's you're kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't, and then it's purely based on what the outcome is. And then I didn't say it in the first part, like, but you look at the injuries that happened and where they were going. You know, we said last week an injury to a winger, you know, kind of messes up their kind of shape and their back line with conditions like that, messes your backfield cover. And also, you know, in conditions like that, you have to have a set piece. And you're probably a bit lucky at scrum time with some of the decisions, but losing your 2 second rows, you know, when you're chasing a game and you've not, and that's not like it is hard to, I don't care how, like, to keep your line out in conditions like that at a functioning high level. When you lose your 2 second rows is very, very hard. I know Burn slots in, but you're still just, you know, you've gone down to where you're in a position where you probably haven't practiced a lot with 2 second rows off the pitch, you know, so particularly when you're one as your captain. So it's just things like that. And Australia, you know, Jeff Parling, incredible coach, and he just picked us under when it got really bad, and all those changes, it just got to a stage where, you know, they had nothing to launch in. And in conditions like that, you just can't chase with no set piece. It's so hard.
Yeah. And I mean, even before the match, when Andy Farrell was interviewed on Sky Sports, he was talking about the conditions. It's important that we play it to the conditions. And then just the abandonment, even if you said that if Owen Farrell had been in there you know exactly what Bundyaki brings. He's just going to punch up the middle and not, but even his handling was a bit off and all that. So I suppose maybe when they got onto the field as well, they seemed to lose that sense of the surroundings. And I don't know, were they more off put by the Lightning break? Because Andy Farrell said it was rubbish after that. The Lions spent their time worse or weren't prepared for it. Neil posted us over a picture, a couple of the Lions players sitting on beanbags. Finn Russell was on his phone. They were joking that, is he tweeting something or is he on social media? And then the Aussies were going through some little drills all on their bikes, because Joe Smith was fully aware of the weather warning and the possibilities of that. Did they deal with that better? And I mean, they immediately got off to a better start upon the resumption.
I think it's you make that narrative whatever way the game goes afterwards. So like if the game had swung the other way, the Lions were really relaxed. They'll go comfortable. They were in their own skin, and you know, you can. But like I think it just shows the difference in coaching styles as well between Joe Schmidt and Andy Farrell. You know, so Andy Farrell has a nice relaxed environment, and that's what has made them and Ireland very successful in the past. Like, they're obviously not under as much administrative pressure. Joe Schmidt's team didn't sit down, like, you know, so I think it's just quite representative of how they approach things. But no, I think with all those things you call it in hindsight, and you said it there actually, you probably, you know, call me a small, but on the Owen Farrell thing, like if you start the game needing go forward, you pick Bundyaki, it just didn't really work out. So like you think that Bundyaki would bring more punch than Owen Farrell. You'd have nothing up the middle if you picked Owen Farrell. But then his first ball up the middle, Bundyaki, when the Lions kind of got possession, he got turned over. You know, they had Peach coming off the wing instead of Lina, and I think it was a Fraser McGrath. They both held him up and got the turnover. You know, so it's very hard to call these things when you're picking your team, like, you know. And yeah, I think the Lions looked, I don't mind the beanbag stuff. I think Finn Russell on his phone, he's that kind of, he has his phone in his warm up anyway. He's changing his songs and kicking away. Very easy to judge that. Like, it probably, you ask a sports psychologist when they lose the game, people might not like that picture, but I don't know. Can you tell, Johnny? Would you have anything?
Not really. I think that's down to, it's something that's never happened before. Obviously, it's happened twice this summer, but in reality, you know, it doesn't happen very often. So how people are going to deal with that is very individualized. So I wouldn't really play into that narrative at all. I think weather conditions, and I said it already, like the way the injuries went for the Lions meant that Bundy wasn't having a great game, but the fact that they gone 6-2, and it actually transpired, they probably needed the 6-2 with all the injuries in the forwards, but then it cuts down their backline options, where at half time with the weather, they can take Bundy off, push Farrell to 12 and be like, right, we're just going to kick the corners here now, you know, be really solid in the backfield, chase, but it takes your options away. And it's funny that it went so wrong from an injury perspective, that, you know, if they had gone 5-3, they would have been under even more pressure with what happened in the forwards. So you know, you can't, it's just how it landed, I think. And again, for me, the whole thing around, you know, freshening it up, how they acted, all comes down to, it's based on results, and it just comes from hindsight. But I do think the Lightning thing, that's purely individualized, and, you know, lads are going to be, you know, react completely differently. And I think, Johnny, you've hit the nail on the head there. Like, Joe's environments are completely different to Andy's, and that's something that everyone has to ask to remember, and all the Irish guys will testify to that too. Like, they're just completely different, so that's down to kind of coach-led stuff too.
Just before we move off a couple of those points, is there an awkward conversation between Andy Farrell and Josh van der Vleer the next time Ireland play England and Wales, where Andy has to big up Josh van der Vleer and say, you're a better player than Ben Earl, you're a better player than Tom Curry, I know you are. And when they play Wales, you're a better player than Jack Morgan, I know you are. And Josh can just look back and go, well, you know, was I not a better player for the Lions series? Right? Would that be awkward at all? See, Josh is such a nice guy that I know he would do something for the team. But, I mean, it's hard to think that he didn't get a cap. He's 32 now. He's fit as a fiddle. He could go in 4 years' time, but very harsh on Josh.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, go, Johnny. Yeah.
Go on, Johnny.
I'm not sure on that. I think that it was just a decision based on how, like, that the back row was always going to be so tight for spots. And I suppose it's down to how Josh van der Vleer reacts to that when he gets back in an Ireland jersey, or when they're playing each other, when they're playing all those guys in the URC or in Europe, that, you know, he has a bit of a chip on his shoulder where he's like, well, I'm going to actually, you know, show I'm better than these guys. Him not getting the opportunity, I suppose that's just down to a good feel on selection. It is probably one of the talking points, in the sense of he's probably a really unlucky one to Pilato, maybe as well. But he had that knock where van der Vleer never had. He didn't have any knocks or anything. So it is something. But I don't think I think, you know, players of his standard and stature would be able to kind of put that into, that's my Lions. Yes, you know, we won a series, he contributed to it, he was a big part of it, but didn't play in the test. But then you move on, and it might, you know, I don't think he's a type of professional that would let that disappointment linger, you know, within. I think he just moves on and gets on with it.
Johnny, what about Dan Sheehan? He got a 4-match ban, reduced to 3 if he goes through tackle school. A lucky boy that TMO, Marius Juncker, didn't pick it up as it happened. He had good line of sight coming into a ruck. This is a clear out that resulted in Tom Lynagh having to go off. He took the kick, but that was Australia without their first choice out half. He says and doesn't accept that it was an act of foul play as well. What did you make of that? The same day, there's another safety instruction from the RFU they will keep the sternum height tackles as well. Player safety is big in the news. What did you make of the Sheehan incident?
I think I actually respect him for saying he doesn't accept it, because there's no mean foul play. Like, you know, it wasn't foul play from his perspective. I suppose it just shows how difficult the ruck situation can be. You know, Lino was in an awkward position in the ruck and then turned around and he's getting belted by Dan Sheehan. For Tom Lynagh's, from his perspective, of course, you don't want him getting an injury that, or a head injury, that a brain injury that makes him leave the pitch on the third test. So, like, you know, your sympathy has to go to him first, and the care has to be over him first. So, like, it is, he's very lucky he wasn't seen. But, you know, him saying, I don't accept foul play, fair enough, like, because he didn't mean foul play. There's a very small window when you're entering a ruck to actually do something meaningful. And I think that goes back to the Jack Morgan thing as well. Where is he supposed to go? So, like, the rocks are very difficult at the moment. How are you supposed to enter them? What are you allowed to come in and do? What are the laws saying? I don't know, we've been through all of that, but you know, I think he's very lucky that it wasn't seen at the time. But I think if you went through a lot of rocks like that, you'd see various things that we didn't capture at the time and referees missed. But yeah, from an Australian perspective, it's probably very frustrating that wasn't caught, because it could be a big turning point in a different game as well. You need consistency with how the game is called. But like, it's funny what the TMO can actually track through and what the TV directors can look through and show back up on, it depends on who's hosting the games and everything else. But there could be loads more going on. So I think in the dynamic of a game, there's probably plenty of them. His one got caught on a replay. Referee didn't see it at the time. TMO didn't catch it in time, etc. The ban is justified. His saying that it wasn't foul play is probably justified, but it doesn't mean that he doesn't deserve to get banned. He probably does, like, you know, what he does.
Yeah, yeah. And he's going to be banned for 3 games. He was unlikely to play as well. So a friendly against Cardiff and a doubleheader.
I think that's the bigger issue, the friendly against Cardiff. Like, come on, you know, that's...
Yeah, I agree with that.
No, I know it's very hard to say, well, he is available for that and he's not available for that, and making bans based on what they think fellas are available for. Fair enough. Like, that's actually a bit of a sticky situation, but everyone knows he's not available for that. So can we just not count the preseason friendly? If it was 3 URC games that he wasn't available for anyway, it's very hard to argue that. But the preseason game is a bit of a joke. Like.
Yeah, I think that should be a meaningful game of some kind, like a preseason game after Lions, where, you know, the lads who are coming back now, they're going to have 4 weeks off. They're going to have another 4 week preseason. So you're not going to really see them until the end of September. So earliest. So it's, I don't agree with that. I think the bigger issue is the, in this whole thing is the TMO and not picking it up. Like, you know, he's picking up something that, you know, the nine chases around on a Brumbies play and barely touches someone and they're looking at something like that rather than this. And then also the last Clyde Byrne tackle, you know, they go back for a late hit. But what about the shot where, you know, there's, again, and we spoke about last week, poor technique coming in high. I know that Byrne is probably starting to go on his way down, but he's completely upright in the tackle. And they look at a late challenge rather than looking at both of them. I do think there's a, like, that, you know, like, that shouldn't be the case, that they're missing two incidences like that, that, you know, are potential head contact and, you know, potential, you know, poor, well, certainly the second was poor technique, but, like, I don't think that's good enough when you do look at some of the stuff that is being looked at or communicated through the TMO, to be honest.
You're right there. The Ty Byrne one was Solihull with the shoulder across. Like, they're looking side by side and having an issue with the late one and that one.
Yeah.
Like, not to kind of sound kind of biased towards everything that Australia did to the Lions. Like, they're both wrong. They're both head contact. Both should be called.
Yeah.
I just found that madness as well. Like, what are you actually showing people that you're looking after? You missed Dan Sheehan, you know, taking the other half out of the game, which is a common thing anyway, if you do it legally. But, like, then the other one is just an open play, very dynamic. You know, give it a yellow card. I think there's a reason for it being a difficult situation, but he still clearly put his head into his, or shoulder into his head. I don't know. It's all very hard to call these days.
Yeah.
Just when I have the two coaches there, and just moving on to the kind of match clinching score. When the Lions tried to move it on the halfway, and Kinghorn gives it, or I think Aki is ahead. Is that the passer's fault? I'd give that as the passer's fault, that if your man has overrun it, you just hold it, go into contact. Is it that simple, that it's Kinghorn's fault for chucking it on?
Well, I think it actually comes down to what Johnny's saying, like, is that you just go on someone's boot and put down the corner and try and go low grubber in, and you can create a lot of problems there if you can get someone sliding into a position, and they've three guys, you know, far less three guys outside him. Well, if he kicks it, he's the third guy, so they can go forward and chase that together against one person. So in conditions like that, you want to try and get people on the ground, you know, having to dive for a ball or slide for a ball, then get back up and force them to kick out. I think it comes from their decision making pre that, and then, like that, you know, three probable critical errors leads to a try, and that's where that comes from. Where, yeah, you're right, no kick, then just carry, you have your cleaners in, and then you control the ball and maybe put your foot on the ball then, and a box kick, you can create a one-on-one. That'd be kind of my view on it. Johnny's already kind of gone through it.
Yeah,
I just wondered that, because Farrell normally kicks it, like, they're everything outside Farrell looked wrong. Was it Tom Curry on the actual edge? I'm not sure, but
it was.
Timing, they weren't really doing a whole lot, and he passed it between the two of them. But I wonder, was Aki getting on a kick chase already? Because Farrell normally tried the true. They were clearly on different pages and they're going lateral and running out of space. It was just poor, really. I think they were not clear on what they were trying to do. But what I didn't like was Blair Kinghorn's reaction, because we saw that in the Argentina game. I actually was critical of Tom Curry for not chasing back in time, and he obviously turned his tour around massively. We'd love to know if you get a clipping for that. But Blair Kinghorn turning to Owen Farrell, kind of saying, like, what are you doing, kind of thing. And I just thought that was a bad look. You know, that was kind of, I'm out of here. And yeah, it could be very different if that kick is just put through.
Absolutely. Well, there's no doubt about that. The Australians deserve to take a test. They were good value. 2-1 is about right. We were just looking at the aggregate score was 68-67 over the three tests. So the Lions won by a point. Probably doesn't tell the whole story as well. But if you look back at the whole tour from what you expected, has it gone along the lines? It was a kind of a slow burner. The second test was obviously a fantastic match. But other than that, did it ever burst into, didn't really burst into life apart from that? Or was it, you know, the second last match of the tour when it really got going?
I think it came to that moment that really got in. They were at each other. They built up. I think there was a huge amount of disappointment with their performance in the first, and they probably Australia's performance in the first, and it was as kind of expected. But I think it certainly did come to light there, particularly with all, you know, how everyone was talking about it, and in the lead up to the game. And I think, you know, reading the papers and even reading Neil and Johnny's thing, like, I think the big thing, and like people were saying about not going there, but like there was 225,000 people through the gates. Like, that's a mad stat, you know. Like, I think that's for the three tests. I think that's, that shows what the brand is. But we were all worried, and we spoke about it, that we didn't want a dead rubber for multiple things, for the brand of the Lions, for Australian rugby in the lead up 2 years out from World Cup. And I think the onus is on them and Joe and Les Kiss now over the next 6 months to build on what momentum that they can get out of that. But it certainly needed a moment and a performance like the second test and a match where everyone was in it right up until the final moment. That was what a Lions series was about. You know, it's just disappointing that we didn't get a first test where, like you said, it was a bit of a, not a lame duck, but it was a bit kind of blah. It just felt so comfortable for the Lions. Even when they got back close, you were just like, the Lions are just going to do, they'll do it, where it just needed that spark. And for me, I think that was by far, that's what made the series.
Yeah, I think I got quite bored in the third test. Just the weather conditions probably, like if you, like I appreciated the spectacle, the tight battle, whatever else. I just didn't really want that kind of game, you know. I didn't want to have to appreciate the turfy stuff. So the weather conditions, I think, just took away a small bit from the third test, although it made Australia grow up a small bit in, I suppose, the squad that they have. I think interestingly, like, you know, you look at the fallout of the tour is that Australian rugby is in a much healthier place financially. That's going to help them enormously going forward. And heading into the Rugby Championship with some of the battle that they've had in the last 1.5 games or 2 games, really, that's huge. And then changing the Gitto law where they can play overseas players now again, could they not have changed that a couple of weeks ago? You know, we would have gotten a cracker of a series. So I think that's the right call as well. But I have a bit of a theory, I suppose, that, you know, Andy Farrell and the Lions, they tried to play an expansive game. And you could see that from the start. And trying to gel that expansive game will, you know, you would have thought if, and Neil called it last weekend or just before the weekend, that you know, if the weather conditions were better, you were waiting for that one game where the Lions absolutely opened up and ripped them apart. We didn't get to see if that would have happened or not because of the weather conditions, and that's probably the part that frustrated me. But, you know, it'd be a lot easier for Andy Farrell to set out, like, they had the power in the first game, definitely, clearly, and they would have won the game anyway they wanted. In the second two, you know, they still probably would have had the power over across 80 minutes. So they could have had a kick chase game, they could have had a very kind of South African World Cup 2019 game plan, and they would have just walked away with the series, I would think. Now, Australia will argue that one as well because they bring that back, the skeletons of Valentini's, and they obviously had their own way with it. But I think over the course of 2 more 80 minutes, the Lions would have just been more cohesive. They would have known their game plan a lot stronger. I think all those things would have led to a very easy and mundane Lions win. So I appreciate the way that the Lions went out to play. They did go out to play, and it didn't work out for them. They were lacking cohesion in some of the midweek games. They even lacked cohesion at times in the tests. And like the line-out, I thought, interestingly, Johnny said it there, losing your 2 second rows. I thought the first 20 minutes before they popped the stat up that Dan Sheehan missed only 1 out of 42 throws or whatever it was, 17 minutes in before they started creaking. I remember thinking, geez, the Lions line-out finally has gotten to know each other. and then you take two boys out of it and you start losing more lineouts in those conditions, you know. So I think it can't be underestimated how much they tried to play with all these different combinations and getting to know each other and what they actually achieved across it. It would be much easier to put the ball in the air and chase it.
I also think that it's kind of created you know, an us against them for everyone in Australia in terms of what they can salvage from this, that it's like, well, we've 2 years now to really prove at a home World Cup that we're back and we're here to stay. And guys like Skelton and Baltini and those guys are so important to that because they just raise the level completely. But I do think that if they can get some momentum in the rugby championship now, that really, and throughout the autumn, Les Kiss comes in, I think it's going to be I think it's from what you read and what you see, like, Aussies hate to be talked down to in any sport that they have, you know, just because they're such a sporting nation, they're so good at all the sports that I think it has really galvanized the rugby public. And there's an opportunity for them with a string of results or a good showing in the championship and the autumn internationals that they can really drive on now over the next 18 months into their home World Cup.
No, and we need to see that as well, because it makes it better for everyone if they're operating at a level that they, you know, that brought them World Cups and Lions series wins. And just from an Irish perspective, we started off with 15 in the squad, ended up with 18, 12 guys involved in the test. It's something that has to benefit Andy Farrell in November and next Six Nations, that you're able to call on Thomas Clarkson, Osborne, that these guys have even that in the background. Mac Hansen as well, and Gary Ringrose, who didn't get a game, but so many that will come back to Irish camp, you know, with next spring intercept.
I think Jamie Osborne, Thomas Clarkson, real winners out of getting out there. Then I think there's, again, an equal and opposite reaction for the Irish squad, is that Andy Farrell's most inner thoughts are probably spread across the Four Nations now. You wonder how much, you know, that kind of lure of Andy Farrell over Ireland will just become normalised across some of the other squads. Maybe it won't. I think if you're emulating anything, you're losing anyway. So maybe he has another step to him. But then again, you get some players like Lowe who fizzled out, Aki who got tired, and, you know, obviously, let's put some context on it, like he had a fifth child while he was over there that he didn't get to meet yet.
Yeah.
So there's always something else going on in the background. Josh van der Fleer, maybe licking his wounds, no doubt he's going to react when he gets back. But I think from an Irish perspective, you wonder how much the other nations got to know them, you know, and how much intelligence was shared. Because when you're Andy Farrell, you're going to share everything. Like, if it's going to work, you have to be very open, and that's the way he is. I wonder how much they got to know what Ireland does as a team, you know. But I think from a player's perspective, there's probably guys coming out of it with a real spring in their step, but there's others who are jaded and need a bit of a rest.
Yeah, the first Lions video had Johnny Sexton giving Marcus Smith some kicking tips, which could come back to haunt us down the line if Mark Smith has already kicked a winner against Ireland. No, listen, and, you know, there is some sort of loose talk about, you know, changing it up and losing Australia from the roster, but, like, there's not really the imagination in world rugby to do anything like that, is there? I mean, they talk about growing the game, but they don't, you know, we grow the game within the Six Nations and the Rugby Championship, and, you know, Georgia and Portugal, you're fine there as you are, lads, but there's not the imagination or the willpower to bust up that system. It's working fine from there.
No, yeah, the only thing that and someone else has mentioned it before, Jim Hamilton mentioned it already, and talking to a couple of actually my friends, like, imagine what a Lions series in you know, in France would be like. I think that would be really cool if you kind of traveled around there. But again, there's, you know, and, you know, you look at the World Cup and the show that they put on financially, you'd get a fair few quid out of it as well. That might be one. Again, if you wanted to open it up, you'd probably have to look at Argentina, given they, but I don't think there'd be the, there isn't the domestic game for them, so you're probably looking at a South America's tour where you're playing the likes of Chile and these guys in your midweek warm-up, so logistically probably not possible. But in anything in terms of having vision or trying to drive the brand more would be something like France, just given the powerhouse they are going to be, and they are. But yeah, I don't think, you know, and also things like people forget, like it's a business at the end of the day, and what drives these decisions is revenue. And I don't think they're going to be lacking for any revenue after the tour, with so many people having gone through the gates through all the games.
I just think, like, I can't remember who I was listening to, but they were talking about Australia being, you know, kind of a wealthy country in terms of what they're going to spend on a touring sporting event, and that's what's come out of the back end of it. But this thing in France, like, I agree with Johnny, it'd be unbelievable to get it to happen, but like a Lions tour in France and what it looks like, non-existent, because we can't even get France to play summer tours, you know. So yeah, it's because their season goes on so long, they're owned by independent private owners, and there's zero link or zero appetite to actually do that. We questioned whether top 14 base players like their Kinghorn could actually go on the Lions tour, and they're all late, you know. So unfortunately, logistically, it's never going to happen, because France is a bit of a minefield, and the season starts too early and goes on too long. Just the player safety stuff in France is difficult enough as it is, you know. So you'd love to see it at full strength, but they didn't even send it full strength to New Zealand. So nothing really for waiting for them.
Yeah.
It's a never-ending season. It is for the rugby journalists anyway. But lads, thanks very much for your time. That's great to put a bow on that. Ireland are next in action in November. And then, of course, before that, we will have URC. It's going to be all about the Women's World Cup now for the next couple of months here in Ireland. And we're going to talk to Hannah O'Connor in a couple of moments. But thanks very much for your time, lads, and have a great summer, or what's left of it.
Cheers, thanks.
So now I'm delighted to have Hannah O'Connor, former Ireland Leinster CYM, of course, and Blackrock star with us. Hannah, thanks for joining the podcast again. Just looking back, it's just over a year since you retired from senior rugby. How's that been? And is it around this time, maybe when you see a World Cup coming, that wish you could go back?
Yeah, I know. It's a strange time. Been a quick year all the same. Different, all right, being on the other side of it, having finished up with Ireland and with Leinster. As you said, luckily still get to have another few seasons with Blackrock yet to not fully go cold turkey. But yeah, it's definitely a bit stranger to be on this side of it, especially as it known that World Cup and stuff was looming around the corner. It's obviously wasn't an easy decision, but something that I'm getting a bit more used to and filling my time with other things. But yeah, all going well so far. So it's nice to be able to be on this side of it and watch the girls in the lead up to this exciting World Cup.
And did you think maybe you might get a phone call when there was a couple of injuries coming in the back five of the scrum?
I don't think there was ever a fear of that now somehow. But yeah, I know they've had a few peppered with a few injuries in places that didn't really need them, and to personnel that didn't really need to lose. But I think Saturday showed signs of kind of green shoots there that they'll be happy with, all right.
Very good. We're going to focus primarily on the Women's World Cup and the two Ireland warm-up games. But maybe just as we're on the Lions topic, and we're just coming out of the Lions mood now. We've been on that for the last couple of months. The next step for the Lions is the inaugural women's tour. So the British and Irish women's team will go and play three tests in New Zealand in 2027. Maybe can I just get your general take on that, what you thought of it when you first heard about it? Because, you know, they did a feasibility study looking at the pros and the cons. It's kind of a big risk. The Lions had such a history, but also associated with huge crowds traveling, famous tours going back. I guess when it was first mooted, everybody would have thought it's just going to be in England 15. Ireland and the other teams may have progressed to have a bit more representation. But maybe tell me your initial thoughts of it when it was announced, and, you know, if you've evolved or come on, or what place does it have in the women's game?
Yeah, I think it'd been years ago now when the whispers were going around that there was going to be a women's one, and no one quite, I think, on the ground quite believed that it was actually going to happen from a women's perspective. I think such was the state of play probably 5 years ago and more within the women's game in Ireland, especially, like, that it was actually going to be a viable thing. And yeah, you can't argue with the fact that back then, looking past an England team, kind of the juggernaut that they are, of having anybody else but English players in there was always going to be the thing as to whether or not it was viable for the women's game to have other, you know, other people and other countries involved in that. But I think, yeah, over the last year or so, obviously with the men's coming to the fore over the summer, and the game evolving in the way that it is, not just obviously in England, but in the other countries as well. Obviously, Ireland have seriously come on in leaps and bounds over the last 2 years. Wales are getting their stuff together with Sean Lynn at the helm now. They seem to have kind of got themselves back on track in time for a World Cup, which would be important to them. And Scotland have been kind of trucking along similar to Ireland in sense of their build as well. So definitely not as in a dire strait as it was probably a couple of years ago. Yeah, obviously England are still that formidable force and are probably tipped to go on and win a World Cup, or they'd fancy themselves to go on and win a World Cup anyway, as they always do. But it definitely is an exciting time for women's rugby. It definitely kind of gives that, you know, it's in that topic of conversation now where people can actually see it being a thing. I think it will gain even more momentum coming off the back of this World Cup. I think England, over the last few years, probably like 5+ years, have shown the rest of the world how it is to run a league of a world-class standard over there. It's where everybody wants to play. It's where we've lost a lot of players international-wise from Ireland to go over and play that top-quality rugby against some of the best in the world. So they've kind of shown a model of how to do it and how it's done and how it can be done. So I think the rest of the kind of the other countries kind of certainly from an Ireland perspective can continue to take note on what they're doing well and how we can adapt it into our own. But I think it's more exciting now. I think they'll do that really well. And I think it'll only add fuel to the fire for that excitement, as you said, for 2027 for the women's tour, similar to the men's.
And as we say, the progression in the Irish team for, you know, the wooden spoon year, you know, you really wouldn't have a candidate. And now over the last couple of years, we'll have, you know, I know we don't really like to do this if the Lions were playing tomorrow, but like Aoife Wafer would be up there in the back row. Aaron King would be knocking around. Sam Monaghan going off the other day again. And it's no coincidence, I suppose, maybe that Aoife Wafer is going over to Harlequins, and that if there are Irish players going to be involved in a couple of years' time, they'll be girls who are operating in the English Premier League.
Yeah, the Premiership is obviously where it's been for kind of the players who want that kind of level of high quality rugby outside of the international window. I think, as I said, IRFU can take a lot of notes from that in terms of providing more supports into the AIL, because I don't think the AIL is a bad league at all, but it just needs the supports need to be given to that a little bit more from the IRFU in terms of building that and actually putting kind of time and money into that. Yeah, I think like you can obviously talk about if it was to happen tomorrow, who would you pick on paper? It's one of those things that, you know, 2027 in terms of a sporting life and in terms of everything else is so far away. And obviously this World Cup will probably see a lot of retirements after it, you know, so that will bring new blood and new gaps to be filled within England, within Ireland, Scotland and Wales. There'll be new gaps to be filled and people could come out of anywhere to, you know, showcase themselves over the course of that year before Lions for the women's is ever picked. So definitely a lot of rugby to be played between now and then to see who gets to put their hand up in that time. But you can bet your life that not one of those players who are in any of those squads will be thinking about that when it comes to this World Cup, will be the first and foremost in their minds anyway.
Absolutely. We might just look at the World Cup now. So just to give people an idea, Ireland are in Pool C. They will play Japan, Spain and New Zealand starting on consecutive Sundays. The first match is on August the 24th in Franklin's Gardens. They take on Japan. A week later, the same venue, they'll take on Spain. The following week against New Zealand, they will be down in Brighton. If everything goes according to plan, that will be a pool decider, please God. But so Ireland are now in the middle of two warm-up games. They've been training since June. And they beat Scotland 27-21 at the weekend. The game itself, Ireland fell behind two early tries, and it wasn't really, they kind of got the first half an hour out of their system. A lot of rust there. They'd come on and they kind of had to win the game twice. So they scored two tries just before half time, another after the break, took the lead, fell behind again. And then the subs, the replacements who come on, help get over the line. Just give me your overall sense of maybe what they would have wanted to achieve and what they saw and how much was put out on the pitch.
Yeah, I think from an Ireland perspective, both players and coaches alike, I think they'll be very happy with Saturday's fair. I think it's the perfect kind of mix of, you don't want to show your hand too early in the sense of blowing it out the park with kind of, you know, the sky's the limit in terms of where you want to build to. But yeah, as you said, like that first half an hour, it was a real sign of a team who was kind of playing their first hit out of rugby in a number of months. You're coming off the back of a grueling pre-season of that 7 weeks that they endured together. So everybody would have been just looking to get back on the pitch and play an absolute test match rugby, essentially. But the first half an hour, yeah, you know, you've got obviously a lot of new bodies in there, new faces in there with the new caps as well. You've got a new defensive coach as well has come in since Six Nations. So you've got tweaks there probably. And it was kind of every sign of that kind of rustiness with it. And it's understandable, obviously, in that sense. But I think what was most pleasing for them is, as you said, like to be able to grind it out, to be able to grind out that kind of those two tries to come back at them after that half an hour spell, they would have been really, really pleased with. I think set piece is something they would have been really happy with as well overall. It was nice to see Cliona Maloney starting there. Like she gives you a serious amount of punch in the set piece and as well as her ability to throw those darts of distance in the in the lineout as well. And that's not saying anything against Neve Jones as well. Like, she's a fantastic player and someone you'd have on the pitch every day of the week. And it's nearly that you'd want the two of them on the pitch, probably Kleena at two and Neve at somewhere like six. But unfortunately, it's not a position that we're flush with. So they're prized possessions, the two of them, in terms of personnel. But yeah, I think as an overall picture, the girls and the coaches would be quite content with that. You know, showed the green shoots of what they're aiming towards, and those flashes of when they get the balls to the backs, where our strengths are, where we've serious speed, serious power there. We managed to score some really good tries. And as I said, set piece being that consistency that we saw in the Six Nations as well would be also something that they'd be happy with, considering the swaps and things. And as I said, players coming back from injury like Sam Monaghan, fantastic to see her back. Emer Curry the same, Derv Nicovord, three players, and Maeve Dealey as well, who's had her fair share of injury trouble the last kind of 12 months. And so they'd be really happy with that, considering they're missing a few important bodies.
Absolutely. And Baveen Parsons as well. But just on Sam Monaghan, because she had three different injuries since she last played, and I was maybe worried that there could be some mental scarring, but really she got through 35 minutes. I think she was withdrawn. That was a pre-planned move. She was smiling as she came off, but it was a real statement of intent, because it's that time when Ireland have lost some quite dynamic back five forwards, and that's as good as I've seen Sam play with so much influence on the game around her.
Yeah, and look, Sam's a huge player for that Ireland team. She's the same when she plays with Gloucester at club level. But to have her back in terms of calling that line out and the dominance she brings in her carries, she just gives such go-forward ball. And as you said, when you take out the likes of a Wafer, a Wall and a King, you're missing that go-forward ball of what they kind of bring for you every game and the carries that they give you. So to have someone of her standard back, and just as a captain, it's been so tough for her, as you said. Like, she's had kind of one injury roll into another when she's nearly been back. It's been very tough, and it's hard because I suppose, as captain, as co-captain with Idel McMahon, you know, she's been there at the front line for it all. A lot of the time when you're injured, you kind of step away and you go through your rehab. But I suppose she's been that voice and been that shoulder for everybody else while she's been going through her own battle with it. So for her to see her back and go through that 35 minutes, as you said, definitely a kind of a pre-planned 35 minutes to ease her back into it after the kind of the year that she's had with it. It's brilliant. It's hugely important. But I think you mentioned there, obviously, the bodies that were missing, and to have someone like Sam back, it also has a kind of a double effect for those players who get the opportunity and put their hand up. Obviously, Grace Moore was named player of the match and is one of the best games I've seen Grace play in a long time. So it gives that gap for you. Yes, you're missing those players of the Kings, of the Wall, of the Wafer, but other people have to stand up. Other people have to front up and take those big carries. And I think we saw that. I think Grace Moore, I think Emer Curry being back as well, gives you something a bit different in the second row. I think having Sive McGrath and Kleena, as I said, starting. Siobhan McCarthy also got her start. It was something different that we haven't seen, kind of that rotation of props as well. They really took their opportunity with two hands as well. And Sive McGrath is another one who's kind of had injury niggles the last year or so. So she'll be another one delighted to get through that with the really good performance at set piece, especially where they'll be honing their craft. But overall, I think, yeah, really, really positive signs there from those parts.
And absolutely. And just on Sam, because I didn't want to let it go without mentioning Fiona Chewett, who had 18 carries in just over half a game. So she came on and showed that you won't be losing anything when she comes on. She was powerful throughout the whole game.
Yeah, no, she had a really good game as well. As I said, she would have known, I'd say, at the time, sorry, on the bench at one stage, she had the jacket off. She would have known when she was coming on. So she would have been able to watch that game, kind of analyse it in terms of what she could bring coming on. And another person similar to Grace that did really well when she came on right through that game, especially, like, obviously Emer coming back into it, it's always tough coming back into it in terms of the lung buster and getting up to that match pace. I think she did really well. But yeah, Fiona really came into it as well as kind of Ireland, as I said, one of the things I'd be most pleased with probably is troubleshooting, being able to fix the problems. They were a bit kind of predictable in that first half an hour and a bit lethargic looking, maybe, and a bit kind of just off the pace of it. Got into the game, managed to turn the screw, and in those kind of those tries that they scored, especially the third and the fourth one, really showed that kind of ability to find the weaknesses of the opposition and kind of hone down on it, as you said, Fiona Chute, you know, big impacts there in her carries as well. So they'll be really happy with that.
Yeah, and Grace Moore, deserved player of the match. I thought Eve Higgins was outstanding as well. She could have easily gotten it. So I just wanted to give her a mention. Just Ireland handed out three debuts. Scott Beaman, he started Ivana Kiripati and Nancy McGillivray, and brought on Ailish Quinn at the end. Nancy wasn't in the preparation squad. So she's kind of come in, parachuted in from the England setup, or from the outskirts of the England setup. What did you see from those players? Do you think, you know, that they can push for a World Cup place?
It's hard to know. Really hard to know. I think I think Nancy McGillivray, it's hard, that 13 jersey. As you said, she come over with the Prem experience, so Scott will like that first in terms of she knows what it's like to play against all these players, playing with Exeter Chiefs over there as well. Obviously, Irish qualified through her dad. you know, I think it's a hard position in that 13 jersey, obviously, and especially the kind of the stamp that Aoife Dalton put on it during the Six Nations. It's not an easy position to make your debut in. So I think kind of similar to everybody else, that first half an hour was a bit of a kind of a kind of steadying the ship bit for everybody. And I think she found her strap really well, and she went really well and got, you know, great minutes in that game as well and got her try as well, which she'll be really, really happy with. So yeah, it's hard to know from her point of view. I think she was a bit of a bolter in terms of, as you said, not being there from the start of that pack. I don't know whether that was, you know, an injuries to some of their centres or not. I'm not sure. But look, she'd be delighted to have gotten her chance to kind of show what she can do. As you mentioned there, Ivana Kiripati as well has been around the last number of years in terms of playing with Connacht. And I know she's been kind of studying overseas, I think, in America as well. But she's been someone who's touted as a big kind of the next big thing. So she obviously got her shot as well. I think she probably found it a little bit tricky at times with the match pace of it in terms of the differences between kind of, you know, that interprovincial level versus international. But again, someone who will have benefited massively and who showed in her big carries and got involved in a few big hits as well. That's kind of her bread and butter, that she'll be really happy to have got through that game as well and you know, made her debut. And as you said, Ailish Quinn, again, someone who I think she really put her hand up as well coming off the bench. It's not an easy place to kind of be sitting on the bench in the nerves building as you wait for the match to kind of go on. But yeah, came on. Another person who kind of got involved straight away, got in with big ruck entries and got a few hands on ball as well. So she'll be delighted with that as well. So those two, particularly two young players, up and coming players, you've obviously got Jane Clohessy, who made her debut in Six Nations as well. So Scott likes to keep people guessing, that's for sure. So you wouldn't know where he kind of likes to let people know where they stand in a lot of ways with things. So everybody will be on their toes, and that's the way he'll like it to keep it. You know, we mentioned in post-match interviews about keeping competition and that it's going to be intense, and he'll definitely have that with the additions of those new players.
Yeah, and, you know, with the absence of Erin and, you know, possibly Aoife, we don't know if she will recover in time. Like, the soundings are that she may be included in the squad with a view to getting a game against New Zealand or coming in for the later stages. Please God, that happens. But Dervil Nikivard, who hasn't got as many minutes as she would have liked since she kind of got back into the squad, she kind of, I don't know, put her hand up again, but she does bring something unique for someone, a back row forward of her size. She's not big, but she just has this buzz about her, this dynamism that she is adding. She's a very clever player. So it's kind of maybe an opportunity for someone like her to put her stamp, because again, she's influential when she gets her on the ball.
Yeah, 100%. And any time over the last number of years Derv has played for club or for province, she's, you know, been standout for that. So it's a tricky one to see, and it's kind of a case of she's almost, you know, stuck in between when two positions. I think she's obviously more back row now, but I know she had the ability to in her early years with Ireland to play hooker as well. So whether she was being used as cover for that or kind of, you know, for the early stages, she seems obviously to have found her position in the back row or kind of to be in that. It's a really tricky one. I think it's a case of almost with Derv, maybe that it's, you know, what the coach is like in terms of what she brings to the picture. I think she's just really unfortunate. I think the timing of her injury at the ACL was really unfortunate too. So I was delighted for her to see her come back on. I think she did really well in both entries that she had. Obviously, Grace Moore went off to get cleaned up for stitches in the first half, and I think you saw what Derv can bring. She's just a menace around the ruck, as you said. She brings a little bit different, but she would cause a menace around a ruck time and around those kind of little jinks and breaking and play and, you know, tackling, release, going again. That's kind of her trademark along with Emer Curry. So she does bring a little bit of something different. Whether he decides to include her in a match day squad going forward, you know, she's definitely put her hand up to show what she can do, and I'm delighted for her in that front. So I guess it's no more than a lot of people. It'll be a nervous wait to see what happens come squad time.
Absolutely. So Ireland outscored Scotland 5-3. They were kind of lucky it wasn't a bit closer. Ireland missed 4 kicks off the tee. So the conversion that Dan O'Brien got was the one she shouldn't have got. It was from the wrong foot on the far sideline. And then she missed a couple of easier kicks. And Enya as well, they weren't, Enya Breen's kicks weren't easy by, but probably you'd be looking at international level to get them. You've kicked for Ireland. At this, where the women's game is, it's important to have somebody that you can rely on to get these kicks, because these games are always close. These group games, you know, won't be blowouts at all. We were talking to Scott Beaman there last week, asked him if Johnny Sexton would come on board, because he's contracted full-time employee with the RFU now.
Yeah.
When the press release came out, Sexton had said he would be working, or it said that he would be working with the men's and women's teams. Did that surprise you at all? Or maybe overall on the kicking, what's going on through a player's head, which is a difficult one that she makes look easy and an easy one?
Yeah, Like, I wouldn't be overly worried. I think, like, we saw in the Six Nations the pressure that Dana came under for the France game in terms of missing those kicks that you would have banked her, and then she comes out the next week against Wales and is absolutely flawless. So she is as chilled a character as you'll meet in terms of that. So I wouldn't doubt that you could see her again this weekend and she'll be absolutely flushing them. What she gives you, what she might miss on the odd kick from the tee here and there, like Saturday, what she can give you with the distance and she has on that left boot in terms of clearance kicks and kicking for territory is huge, especially when the set piece in the line is ticking really, really well. It's huge. Like, so that's kind of invaluable to Ireland. I think that's a lot of time why we see Dana having, you know, solidified her place there as the starting 10 jersey, is the ability to kick from hand and to kick for clearance. So I don't think she'll be overly worried about those kicks, and the same for Enya Breen. I think it can be like Musgrave, having kicked there myself, it is a really tricky place to kick because it's such a whirl of a wind and you never know whether it's coming from left or right, up and down the pitch. It's a bit of a tricky one. So you take that into consideration as well. It's not an easy place to go. So yeah, they'll have another opportunity, I'm sure, the two of them or whoever gets the nod this Saturday when they play Canada. So another chance to kind of get rid of the rustiness of it there. But I wouldn't be overly worried about that. The Sexton link, yeah, look, I think they do have, I wouldn't be overly worried about that too. I think that was a kind of a thing in the media that a lot of people liked. Obviously, the excitement of having Johnny Sexton back in the coaching perspective within the RFU was probably the draw for a lot of people, and the excitement, I'm sure it was, for the kickers. But at the same time, they've had, you know, some kicking coaches in there under the radar that I've mentioned before in previous interviews, that the setup that's there in terms of the coaches for each specific area, it's worth its weight in gold. And I know they have that there in a kicking coach as well. So I wouldn't be overly worried about that if Johnny does or doesn't get involved.
Yeah, no, Gareth Steenson's there and he's so much experience with Exeter. And no, there was one when the Lions did release a video, their first video diary thing, it was Sexton giving tips to Marcus Smith. And no, he's a guy who could you know, beat Ireland with a kick next year. But that's fine. So as you say, Ireland are playing Canada on Saturday up in the Affidea Stadium, which is Ravenhill in Belfast. Yep. It's 12 o'clock on Saturday against Canada. Again, Scott mentioned before, these games not really about results, but seeing a bit of cohesion. Canada ranked 2 in the world, beat Ireland 21-8 last year in the WXV. Likely to see a lot of changes because there's a list of players there that haven't played in a long time that need to get the minutes under their belt. Again, what would you set out for an expectation for this continued cohesion in the areas you mentioned, I presume?
Yeah, I think that continued cohesion, I think they'll be under no illusions that it's a seriously different test against a Canada squad. As you mentioned, they're second in the world. They're quite a wily outfit. They've kind of been there. We saw there in the WXV one of the difference kind of in the class that Ireland are getting a bit better at of turning the screw against opposition when you have that kind of, you know, you have that territory pressure and you have that kind of ability to turn kind of, you know, territory into points. Ireland have been getting better at that over the year. I think you see that big time in the likes of a Canada. They kind of have that serious physical power up front that they're able to punch those holes. And I think that's what Ireland did very well around that half hour mark at the weekend. They were kind of guilty of that predictable kind of attack where it was very deep and very floaty balls from Molly, where it was Scotland were able to come up and suffocate them. And they flicked the switch then and became more punchy and direct. I think against Canada, they're going to need to show that as well. Become that more direct running, you know, bigger carries from those girls that show that they're well capable of doing it, and then to allow the backs to play. So again, as you said, God only knows who he'll pick. There is a lot of players that still have to play on this kind of block and that have kind of been eking their way back into training from injury. So I don't know who actually is still in the injury or the rehab club, but there are definitely a few people itching to get a few more minutes under their belt, as you said, to put up their hand ahead of kind of that travelling squad when they go. So different test, but I think layering it on, I think the defensive picture will be something he'll look at big time. I think especially off, I said, the back of having a new defensive coach in there, you kind of want to be getting confidence in performing against a big team attack-wise like Canada, but more so that you're able to defend for long periods of pressure against the likes of the Canada. They're going to have that against New Zealand in that group game, as you said, but it's to be able to do it for long periods of pressure against the likes of what a Canada can bring against you would be a big thing. So they'll be looking for more dominance in their defence for sure. I think they were lacking a bit of that in that first half an hour of kind of sitting back a little bit and let Scotland dictate it. You can't let the likes of a Canada dictate the pace of the play because you'll find yourself kind of under severe pressure from the get-go. So that'll be something. But a lot easier to kind of build on those things when you're coming off the back of a win. So, you know, that's kept momentum for them off the back of the Six Nations. So they'll be looking for more of the same.
Yeah, and it was this time last year that Ireland played Australia up there. It was the start of the second resurgence, and Aaron Keane came on and made such an impact. Go just looking slightly ahead to the World Cup. I mean, this time, whatever, 6 months ago, we would have been so excited with Erin King and Aoife Wafer and Dorothy Wall back to her best as well. From your contacts there, with your former teammates, is there any sense that the mood that have taken a bit of a body blow in losing those players, and that Spain and Japan are never beaten easily at all, yourself.
Yeah, like I think, yeah, probably at the time there was that the body blow, especially them coming one after the other, kind of bum, 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 week on week. I think obviously Wafer's one being more kind of fresher. She's been really unlucky player in terms of the highs and the lows of sport. You've never probably seen it more alive and well than with Wafer in terms of how her injuries kind of come about. I think the only benefit to it is that there's been a lot of time. There's been a lot of time. They've had this whole 7 week block to be without them and to be training without them. And for, as I said, other people to step up, the likes of Grace Moore, who's been around a long time. You saw Brittany Hogan as well talking a lot on Saturday to the referee once she kind of was in that earshot and kind of having those conversations as a senior player. So that's another flick of the switch. Other people step up. So there's, where you think that other people are irreplaceable, it's very much a kind of next up mentality where other people have gotten their chance to step up and put their hand up for selection of kind of nailing on spots to jersey. So yeah, I think had it been closer to this World Cup starting, there probably would have been more of a body blow, but everybody will have had that 7 weeks to get their rotations in and get familiar with each other. So it's not as bad as it could be, I think.
So, and before we go, I must mention the Vodafone Women's Interpros series starting this weekend. Ulster are in Dublin to take on Leinster, and Munster are hosting Connacht down in Cork in Musgrave Park.
Yeah, huge weekend. It's an exciting summer for those girls not involved in the international setup. And whereas the eyes might be on, as we mentioned, the up north in the Affidea Stadium, the Interpros gives that opportunity this summer, especially to those players who want to put their hand up for further kind of successes in Ireland jersey. So it'll be a really interesting year. Obviously, from my perspective, I would be hoping the Leinster can go three in a row. But I have a lot of club mates involved across the provinces, and seeing someone like Maeve Óg kind of back from injury as well gets to captain Munster. Got Molly Boyne stepping up to captain Leinster, and she did a fantastic job. And another person who's back from injury is India Daly, who is captaining Ulster. So it promises to be an exciting campaign. I think probably a few upsets on the cards. As I said, I'm hoping Leinster will be able to do the job, but I think there'll be some good matches to watch. So hopefully everybody can tune into that too on Sunday.
That's brilliant. Listen, Hannah, thanks again for your time. Really good to have your insights here on the RT Rugby podcast. And we'll be on again next week to check in after the Canada match and the Women's Interpros. And thanks again.
Cheers. Thanks, Michael.